Back here on 3D, 2D today. Darren McFarland and Willie Donick with you. We're live here at Bridgestone Arena. Predators and Dallas Stars tonight. Puck drop at 7. I'll have pregame starting at 6 right here on 102.5. The game, then the Predators will take off for Chicago on Saturday night. They will play the Blackhawks at the United Center. Let's bring in our man. By the way, silly underdog picks coming up in the third hour. Also, Tommy Tuberville. He will be on the call in the booth for the Tennessee-South Carolina game. Richard Deitch from Sports Illustrated, the author of The Media Circus. Richard, how you doing?
I'm good.
So what did the other night mean, Tuesday night, what did that do for soccer in this country, the blow of losing to Trinidad?
And Tobago.
And Tobago, which I think is the population of a city, like Memphis in our state. That's like the population of it. But, you know, not even getting a tie, but not qualifying for the World Cup in, what, 30 years. What has that done for soccer in the States?
I mean, it's bad. There's no other way around it. Just because the World Cup provides you with, you know, one of the great marketing opportunities for your sport that exists, probably the best opportunity, even though the MLS obviously is season-long, market for soccer, and there's other stuff, Champions League, Premier League, et cetera. But, you know, this is it's arguably the greatest sporting tournament in the world, depending on how you look at the Olympics versus the World Cup. And so, not that anyone expects the United States to win, but we have, I think, matured as a soccer country to the point where there's an expectation where we're going to make the tournament every 4 years. So it's a devastating moment for U.S. soccer in terms of what is the future of this program and where are they going to go with leadership. You know, when you sort of go beyond that to the media, it's a disaster for Fox. They still have future World Cups, and those future World Cups, particularly if there's one in the States, will be unbelievably successful and profitable. But this is a killer. If you look at the ratings and the viewership for the U.S. games in 2014 and 2010, you know, you're getting double-digit millions for those group stage games, over 10 million, in some points 18 million. You're not going to come close to that in terms of any of these other games, even if it's a big-time team like Spain or Portugal or Germany, et cetera. So, you know, Fox probably loses 25% of its audience, I'd say, as a minimum. But beyond that, they lose momentum for the tournament and for soccer. That's the killer because, you know, the U.S., if the U.S. makes the tournament, just think of how many months there is in terms of marketing and build-up and campaigns. You know, I think it was 2014 when the I Believe That We Will Win campaign came out. And, like, that was like a drumbeat for soccer for, like, 5 months before the actual tournament. So it can't be overstated how bad it is for U.S. soccer. I mean, soccer's not dead in America. It's still going to be a very vibrant sport, and it's only going to grow given the demographics. But you can't really undersell it. It's a terrible, terrible day for and week for U.S. soccer.
We've all at some point in our adult lives, maybe it's big, maybe it was a small purchase, but we've all had buyer's remorse. I suspect Fox has huge buyer's remorse knowing what they know now. But I guess for what you just said, Richard, how does this happen? I mean, how is it our country? I mean, we've done a pretty good job, but you know, the women have been able to do it. The women, even in hockey, have also been able to conquer things that the men can't do for the most part. But what is it about this sport that our country that prides ourselves on being pretty damn good at everything we do, we just can't get past this one. We cannot really be, I guess, truly competitive when you think about it on the world stage.
Well, a couple things there. First, I don't actually think Fox has buyer's remorse,
really?
The way, and I'll tell you why. Yeah, no. I mean, I think they're really, like, kind of devastated and have no idea at the moment sort of what to – I mean, listen, they have an idea what to do. They'll broadcast a tournament, but I don't think they have any idea how to market it at the moment. But you got to keep in mind, the contractual obligation that Fox has with the World Cup is ultimately going to lead to a U.S. World Cup, I think, most likely in 2026. That is in whatever they paid in this cycle, they're going to make an infinite amount of money on that tournament because the viewership for a U.S. tournament in the U.S. will just be insane, and they'll be able to make a ton of money through sponsorship. They also did very, very well with the women's tournament in 2015. Record ratings for them, including on FS1, and they made money on that. So, and then finally, keep in mind, they have a relatively new network, and they need programming, and soccer's a big amount of programming for FS1 and FS2. So, no, I don't think they're I don't think there's buyer's remorse. I think, though, for this particular cycle, you know, it's whatever, it's going to be a $50 million loss or whatever, but, you know, it's Fox. They have seemingly endless amounts of money. In terms of, you know, I think in terms of success, so much of so much having as someone who sort of follows soccer, a lot of the countries in the world are just set up differently than how we are in terms of why their players become as great as they are. And in particular, it's the youth academies that a lot of these you know, very famous clubs in Europe have that could take the best of the best 6- and 7-year-old, and you put them in like basically an academy where they go to school and they play soccer all the time. I mean, that's the system, I think, to how you get great players. I don't know if that could be duplicated in the States. We have high schools, we have colleges, and we have a country where soccer is not the sport of choice for most of the athletes in this country. Now, I'm not one to say, like, imagine if LeBron James or imagine if Russell Westbrook went into soccer as kids, we'd be the greatest country in the world. Like, I don't think there's a guarantee that that would be the case. If you told me every kid only played soccer and no other sports, then yes, based on population, I think the U.S. would have won some World Cups. But I don't know what the solution is in terms of how we're going. I don't know if it's set up for us to be a top four soccer country year after year. I do think, though, and this is what my colleague Grant Wall wrote, if you sort of dedicate a little more professionalism to U.S. soccer in terms of hiring more full-time people at the top, making sure you have a technical director who could sort of run the sort of the overall framework of this from the kid level to the MLS level, then I think it gives you a better shot to get great pools of players where the coach of the national team ultimately can choose, can choose a player. Finally, and again, this is not to excuse the U.S. team, but it's a little bit of a fluke what happened. They got themselves in trouble by actually having the Trinidad and Tobago game mean something. That's on the U.S. players and program, et cetera. But so, you know, literally, like, so many things odds-wise had to happen that night for them to be eliminated, and just by randomness, it all happened. You know, you flip the Mexico score around. If you guys watched the game, the U.S. had a shot that hit the post with about 15 seconds left. That goes in, and they go to the they go into a sudden death elimination against Australia. So a lot of things conspired against them for them to be in this position. But, you know, make no mistake, they lost the World Cup in the games leading up to this game. And that should not be the case in CONCACAF, which, generally speaking, is a very forgiving and easy region. So, the players and the administration have no one to blame but themselves. But with all that said, it still ended up, you needed one of the craziest nights in qualifying history for the U.S. not to make it.
Did you want to say something about that?
Well, you got me interested, Richard, in talking about how we develop the athletes. Because Bob Ryan from the Boston Globe years ago was the first one who sort of put forth the whole question of we do it so differently than the rest of the world, not specifically with soccer, but with all of our sports. And we were doing it more in the context of the cheating that goes on in the NCAA. But he's like, this is how we want it, right? We want to have the ability to root for our school, even if there's some stuff that goes along with that, the competitiveness and the cheating that goes with it, where you're tying academics to athletics. Whereas in Europe, and really all around the world, especially with soccer and with tennis, right? We have this discussion with tennis, U.S. tennis as well. that the clubs, the academies, going forward, that's it's always been separate from where you go to school. So that's really the central question, right, is do we need to do a – like, I'll give you another example, hockey in Canada, right? You leave home at a very early age there. If you're really good, you're probably gone from your home by 14 or 15 years old to play hockey and go to school elsewhere. But
correct.
We're so tied to rooting for our school and the high school system and the college system, it's hard to break away from that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the college system and high school system works for certain sports for us to be the dominant nation. Basketball is the perfect example. The best players know that they're going to go to the AAU route, and they play against each other, and they get better. They know that they're at least for 1 year, going to go the NCAA route, and that's sort of the filter system. In tennis, you know, in at least in this country, when we have a great sort of run, generally speaking, it's a group of players who go to private academies. They play against each other from like ages like, you know, 9 to 17, and that's how they get good. And then they go on the tour, and, you know, some of them make the top 10, some of them don't, but that's the system. In Europe, you know, Leo Messi went to the Barca Academy and played with all these great players from the time he was 8 years old. And then by the time he's 17, he's on the main team of Barcelona. By 18, he's starting. And he then plays for Argentina. He's one of the best players in the world because he has this club system. I don't know how that for U.S. soccer is going to manifest itself outside of, and this is the caveat, is that you probably, the way to get better players, at least by the way the system is set up, is one, identify the kids who are great at soccer early, and hopefully they're committed to it. And two, but this is asking so much on parents, it's to basically go to Europe or to go to other countries where they have these kind of developmental systems and play in those academies. So, you know, like if you're, you know, you're a great player and you play for one of these German youth club teams like Bayern Munich or Dortmund or something like that, or Leverkusen, and then the U.S. player at 18 or 19 is playing in like the top league, German league, or the top Spanish league, and then they come back to the States as 19 and 20 year olds and, you know, are top flight players. And you hopefully you get 10 or 11 of those guys, but it's not going to be easy for soccer. I mean, I think we can get a little better to the point where, you know, to me, given our population, we should be a top 15, top 20 squad every year. But you know, I don't subscribe to the sort of American exceptionalism somehow that because we're America, we should be number one and we're going to be number one. I just don't buy it. We're not a soccer culture. You know, you have kids in certain countries, in Germany, in Spain, in Chile, or, you know, which didn't make it, but I'll just use that as an example, in Uruguay, where, like, there are kids, like, at, you know, age three, just playing, like, every day on the streets of those, you know, on those streets or in the communities where, you know, you get 11 kids to go to the park or whatever, or the green. That's what they do. That's not the case here in the States. It's just there's too many other options for kids, from different sports to video games. So I don't see it. I think soccer is a really interesting, uniquely creative sport where the greatest goal scorers of all time are kind of like musical prodigies and geniuses. You know, they just figure out different angles and they see the field and the lines differently. We as a country have been much more very technical. You get guys who are great athletes who can run all day, you know, a lot of times sort of kick the ball down the sides and sort of outwork or outgut other teams. Now, that should be enough to make the World Cup every year, but I just do not believe, and again, I could be proven wrong, but having been a soccer fan and watcher for a long time, I just do not believe that our country is set to eventually beat the Germanys and the Spains and the Italys and the countries that have been true soccer powers for generations.
Richard Deitch, SI.com, on the line with us. Jemele Hill suspended 2 weeks for a second violation of social media guidelines at ESPN. What did you think about that story this week?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, we could do 5 hours on this topic because it's pretty multi-layered and complex. I'm not even sure where to go. I guess for the purposes of being a little quick.
Well, let me ask this, Richard, real quick, before
okay,
go into this. You are, I've said it, you know, we've said it many times on this show, you know, follow you on Twitter. You're a good follow. You're a guy wide-ranging, as all of our listeners know, when you come on here. Basically, we can toss anything in your lap, and and you can run with it. So you're a guy that has opinions, but you also work for Sports Illustrated. You're an employee. So what are you allowed to do? What are you allowed to do because you're a guy that's not afraid on social media to get out there and get involved in conversations? That's kind of your job too, is to also follow this stuff. So what are your boundaries in what you can do, Richard Deitch, with your own social media accounts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the overall boundary is not to embarrass the parent company, which is, in my case, Time Inc. Where it gets to Jemele Hill, and this is always sort of tricky terrain, is ESPN historically has been, you can do a lot of things as an ESPN employee. The one thing you generally can't do is to criticize ESPN or to start screwing with their money. And that's sort of the line where Jemele Hill went to with her comments on Twitter. But it's pretty important here to, I think, be nuanced. Obviously, your employer has the right. You have a First Amendment right to speech, and then your employer has the right, private sector employer, to discipline you if they feel that you have said certain speech somewhere that is not, whatever, befitting of the company or violates your contract, et cetera, et cetera. So we know all that. ESPN has the right to do what they want. I don't argue that. What is interesting, though, here is what Jemele Hill tweeted. And this is where you, I think, subjectively have to make your decision. Do you read that as she tweeted out that people should boycott these companies, which also have business relationships with ESPN? And obviously, ESPN has a major business relationship with the NFL. It's their most important relationship. If ESPN doesn't have that relationship with the NFL, ESPN is an ESPN. So that's one read. And if you read it that way, you're like, they should suspend her forever, they should fire her, blah, 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 blah. If you read it another way and you say, she's making the point that the most effective way to clap back or protest Jerry Jones saying that my players are going to line up and salute or stand for the flag. You know, he's demanding that as an employer, as an owner. If you read her take as saying, hey, the way to sort of get back at that is to boycott this guy in the pocketbook because the players probably can't do it. So if you want to make your voice known to a guy like Jerry Jones, what you do is you hit him in his wallet, and that's sort of the best way to make your point. Now, that's not her coming out and saying, don't patronize AT&T, don't patronize Coors, don't patronize Volkswagen. That's her saying this is the effective way to protest. So to me, as management, depending on how you read that, is ultimately how you're going to make your decision. ESPN obviously read it as this is an attack on our business. They suspended her 2 weeks. I also think part of that was, as I've always said on your show, I think they like to send messages to employees where they say, do not screw with the business, do not screw with the money, do not touch the third rail. So it's pretty interesting to me because I think you could actually read what she tweeted different ways. And having reported this out a little bit, I can give your listeners, I think, a honest account. I do not believe Jemele Hill that night went out to tweet as an activist and to try to sort of cause a, something larger. I think she was just basically matter-of-factly saying, hey, this is kind of the way to go if you really want to hit guys like Jerry Jones. But, I'll just end with this. ESPN is screwed. I mean, really massively screwed, and here's why. They have antagonized people on the right and those who are waving the flag there because there is that perception out there that they're left-leaning and that they're trying to shove social issues down your face. And now they've antagonized people on the left who are like, you've silenced and chilled one of your employees, particularly a very popular employee as a person of color, and you don't have the backs of people like us. So they're in a spectacularly bad position of alienating essentially both sides of the political spectrum. And that is where they are now, and that is a horrible place to be. And to be honest with you, I don't know how they're getting out of that so soon. I think they suspended Jemele Hill, in all honesty, in part because I think they wanted the news cycle to go away for the moment. And, it'll go away today, and it'll go away tomorrow, but it's not going away forever, and it's certainly not going away forever as long as Donald Trump's in the White House. So I'll just be totally blunt with you. They're screwed. They do not have an easy out on this because, in my opinion, they have alienated both sides of the political spectrum with their decisions. So they are You know, again, the business can be fine. They make a lot of money still, but they have become part of a major, major culture war, and I do not see that going away anytime soon.
Mm. Good stuff as always. Richard, really appreciate it. Have a good rest of your week, and we'll do it again next week.
You got it. By the way, Yankees Astros.
Oh boy. Do we really need to go there? No. I wanted to avoid
the Zinger on the way out.
Yeah, thanks.
New York is back. We finally have a winning team.
All right, Richard Deitch. Sports Illustrated. It was so good until the very, very end.
If we had more time, I would love to hear his take from just being in New York, the 180 that I'm sure the Yankee fans did on Joe Girardi.
Yeah.
You know, John Smoltz was talking about it the other day. He says there was not a single Yankee fan that called a talk show after that game when they were down 2-0 and back in New York on the off day. He said they were absolutely roasting him.
Of course.
And now 3 games later, they're moving on.
And as Richard said, the news cycle has moved on in New York about
yes.
That. We'll come back and wrap up the second hour of 3D next.